I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
Look, Tina, let's kick off with you. Gee, it's been a big week in Queensland politics.
In 6 weeks' time, voters in Queensland will head to the polls to choose their next state government.
To decide whether to vote in an LNP government or allow the Labor Party to remain in the parliament. It's already shaping up to be a bitter race.
But with the coronavirus consuming airwaves and putting Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk on people's TV screens day after day, the election is shaping up to be about one issue: Queensland's COVID-19 response.
This is about keeping the health of Queenslanders safe. If we are safe, this means that our economy can continue to function.
Today, how Queensland's election became all about the pandemic and the Premier. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of September.
I just checked the levels, but I don't think I've touched anything since last time, so it should be fine.
Ben Smee is The Guardian's Queensland correspondent.
I'm in, so... I'm ready.
Okay. Ben, there's an election in Queensland next month. The current Labor government came to power in 2015 and will be trying to win its third term. Can you just take us back to their first election win, though? How did they come to power?
Well, I said it was going to be a David and Goliath battle, and it certainly was.
In 2015, Anastasia Palaszczuk won her first election. At the time, she was called the accidental premier.
3 years ago, we would be making history tonight.
6 years ago, she was here as a first-time minister. After the previous election, no one picked Anastasia Palaszczuk as the next premier.
Well, I don't think anybody thought that 2012 would just basically wipe out all the current leadership and future leadership of the Labor Party, with the exception of Anastasia. She was the last woman standing.
She beat Campbell Newman's LNP government. They had the biggest majority of any government in Australian history and were kicked out after a term.
Ms. Palaszczuk is the first woman to lead an opposition into government in Australian electoral history. And now, appointing a cabinet dominated by women.
My friends, my fellow Queenslanders, thank you so much for that lovely warm welcome. I'm proud to have Bill here today, and I thank him for the visits he's made in recent weeks.
What did we know about Anastasia Palaszczuk at that point?
Palaszczuk is the daughter of a long-time former Labor MP, Henry Palaszczuk. She grew up in Brisbane's working-class southwest suburbs, and she was a relative unknown when she became Premier. She'd been a Labor MP for a few years, but she had led an extremely small team that really wasn't expected to return to government. She has a kind of a folksy way, I think is probably the best way to describe it. And that really kind of offset what was a quite kind of brash and abrasive government led by Campbell Newman at the time.
The Premier is in the building, Andrew. We've seen her car roll in, and she is just making some final greetings of people in the room just next door. We've got one of the Labor Party officials is making some announcements. So all these people here are waiting very keenly, as you can see. There's a very jubilant mood amongst the people here. They've been waiting very patiently.
So that was a surprise win in 2015 when she was relatively unknown. What happened in the 2017 election?
And we're going to take you live to Brisbane now, where Anastasia Palaszczuk is about to address the Queensland media.
Over to you, Premier.
Good afternoon, everyone. This morning I received a call from Tim Nicholls, leader of the LNP, conceding defeat in the state election, and I wish him and his family...
As a Premier, she is the most successful female.
That's a very good point.
This is the first female Premier to get elected from opposition and get re-elected. Mm-hmm. First one in Australian history.
Yes, I was going to make that point.
Mm. In 2017, Labor's victory was built around gains in Brisbane and a defence of its regional seats. It was a two sides of the street strategy, and that was really evident in the way it positioned itself on issues, particularly the Adani coal mine.
At the start of this campaign, she said she's going to have to climb Mount Everest all over again. She's made a pretty good effort. She's hit a couple of potholes along the way. It was a close campaign. We know that she made that controversial call on Adani.
You say two sides of the street strategy. What does that mean?
Queensland is the most decentralized state in the country. It's the only mainland state where more people live outside of the capital of Greater Brisbane than live inside. But the numbers, you know, it's about 50-50. So any party that wants to win government has to win both regional areas and city areas. And in some of those places, the sorts of arguments and policy positions, you know, really contrast in terms of what voters want. So what we saw at the last election with regard to Adani, for instance, was that in terms of talking to city voters, Labor were out there saying that they weren't going to be putting any public money towards the Adani coal mine, for instance. But when they went out into the regions, they made it clear that they supported the project and that they felt that if it stacked up, that it should go ahead. So these are the sorts of political arguments that get made in that sort of context, you know, and I think the real kind of crucible for that is energy politics. So this clash between jobs, climate, coal, the protection of the Barrier Reef, for instance. These are things where, you know, city voters or voters in inner city progressive seats have very different priorities to those in regional seats. And no one can really win government without really cobbling together a sort of a coalition of city and regional areas. So Labor has absolutely been better at this two sides of the street strategy in state politics than they have been at federal elections. They've won every state election bar one since 1989. And the Liberal National Party has really struggled in Queensland politics to get its message across in city areas. You know, federal election, it's a different story. You've got a Liberal-led federal coalition that does appeal to voters in Brisbane, the Sunshine Coast and the Gold Coast, far more than the LNP, which is still really national-led in Queensland, tends to do at state election time.
So how was all this influencing what people were thinking about this year's state election?
At the beginning of the year, I think there was some consensus that this was going to be a very close election. Pollsters were largely predicting a hung parliament, at the very least a close result. And that's because there have been these sort of shifting political sands in the city and the regions, and no one really saw the shape of the parliament, which is very close as it stands, changing substantially. So Labor holds effectively a two-seat majority in parliament, 48 of 93 seats. There's a very large crossbench. There's a Green, there's three Qatar MPs, there's a One Nation MP. And the Liberal National Party really needs to win 10 additional seats in order to win power. But of course, since we had been first thinking about what this election would hold, everything's changed.
What we are seeing across the world, in Europe now, we're hearing about further waves, large number of cases happening in other parts of the world.
How so? What do you mean by that?
This election's really going to be about one thing, which is the coronavirus pandemic.
We want to protect that lifestyle. We want to protect the health. We want to protect their safety. We want to protect their jobs. We want to get people back to work. That's my priority. And everything we do is about making sure that Queensland is safe.
It's 6 weeks to go, and a political operative from one of the parties told me this week that rule number one is no kissing babies, no shaking hands. Candidates and party volunteers in Brisbane are standing at roadsides waving signs like they're advertising pizza. We've had aircraft take to the skies over Brisbane with messages condemning Palaszczuk, and then the next day you'll have another one going up supporting her. So you haven't seen politicians wandering the streets. You haven't seen rock star politicians from Canberra come up and try and engage with voters. You haven't really seen election stunts or people visiting regional areas to the extent that you normally would. And we've had election debates and forums that have all taken place via video calls. So it's a really strange environment.
So if the pandemic has changed the way parties are campaigning, has it changed anything else about this election?
The whole election is going to be about the pandemic itself. It's really a single issue election. And that is, I think, overwhelmingly because you have a government whose primary task at the moment is to handle the pandemic.
All right. So obviously everyone heard this morning we had zero new cases, which is excellent news. And of course,
so you have Anastasia Palaszczuk and her deputy and health minister, Stephen Miles, every day out there briefing about what the latest coronavirus test results have shown.
And the number of tests that have been conducted in the last 24 hours
has been 10,558. So I really want to thank everyone for going out and getting...
how the management of the pandemic is changing. So rather than a campaign where you see parties trying each day to set out their own agenda and their own message and talk about what they want to talk about, there's really none of that. This is all about the pandemic, and the focus, as much as anything else, it comes down to Anastasia Palaszczuk as the leader of this government, how she is performing, and whether people at the end of this election campaign have faith in her ongoing performance as Premier.
Well done, Queensland. And this is exactly the hard work of everybody that's getting us to this point. But of course, we know that we're still not out of the woods yet, but I'm so pleased that we have...
So how is she performing then?
So far, people have been very positive about her performance, her handling of the pandemic, which has included closing the borders, which has included kind of an amped up Queensland first sort of parochial rhetoric, has been really popular. Her approval rating jumped 38 points between the last two news polls. So on 29 July, her net satisfaction rating was 35, and that's up from -3 in October last year. Going out and briefing and giving people that kind of critical daily information about the coronavirus has meant that her social media following has swelled by about 400%. You know, she now has this direct line to about 190,000 people every time that she posts something online. It's, you know, it's a politician's dream to have that sort of a profile come election time. And at the same time, she's able to get out there and be seen as not necessarily just campaigning, but doing what she's supposed to be doing, which is focusing on the pandemic rather than having to crisscross the state and speak to voters. And I guess that process has really focused the campaign far more intently on the coronavirus.
So that sounds pretty good for Labor.
I think it's good in terms of the fact that Labor are able to have a plan for the election, right? They are able to set out a campaign strategy, which is steady as she goes. They're building a real presidential-style campaign around Palaszczuk and her leadership and those popularity numbers. She's capitalized on that as much as she possibly can. Now, for instance, at state briefings, they're talking about numbers in other states that kind of compare Queensland in a favourable light. Labor has really used the popularity of what they're doing at this point to wedge the opposition.
Have you sort of backflipped on your own position on keeping the borders open for businesses?
Oh, look, not at all. The LNP have always been very clear, get the borders open.
So in April and June, as the first wave of coronavirus looked as though it was starting to die down, there were very strong calls from the opposition here, the Liberal National Party, to reopen the borders.
It is important that our borders get open again.
It is safe to open the borders.
It is just stunning.
There is no health reason to say that the borders should be shut.
Labor has made great hay out of the fact that they've counted 64 times that the opposition leader, Deb Frecklington, said that the borders should be opened, and they've used those soundbites over and over, and we can really expect to hear them until the end of the election. The LNP has, meanwhile, backtracked, and it now supports the policy of keeping the borders shut.
Okay, so if they're kind of supporting that and seem to be in lockstep with Labor on that, how will they fight the election?
It's incredibly interesting because the election is all about Palaszczuk simply because it's about the coronavirus. So the LNP's real, you know, the only tactic that they're left with here is to attack Palaszczuk personally. One LNP MP said to me that, you know, the election will really be decided about by whether people still have faith in Palaszczuk at the end of the process. And what we saw the week before last was an increasing number of attacks coming from interstate and from federal figures who were kind of acting as campaign surrogates for the LNP in a way that allowed them to throw some haymaker-type punches and see what would land.
It devastates me. It prompted an extraordinary prime ministerial intervention.
I rang the Premier this morning and I've appealed to her to overrule the decision.
So we saw the Prime Minister intervene over the case of a Canberra woman who wasn't given an exemption to attend a stepfather's funeral, even though the ACT hasn't had a COVID case for months.
Surely in the midst of all of this heartache in COVID and everything that everyone's going through, surely just this once, this can be done.
And it became a huge national story. You know, we had this plane looping the city, trailed by the slogan, "She is heartless." And everyone on the ground knew exactly who she was meant to be. And we started to see media stories that really did seek to kind of hit on what were apparent inconsistencies in the state's border procedures.
The Queensland government has been accused of startling hypocrisy over its border crackdown, allowing in hundreds of AFL staff and families while denying others basic medical care.
Because they had given exemptions, for instance, for AFL executives to come to the state in order for it to host the AFL grand final a week before the election.
From the coronavirus capital of Australia and into the Gold Coast, 400 Melbourne-based AFL executives and WAGs allowed across what is supposed to be a border ban for Victorians.
There was, you know, this sort of back and forth about who was responsible for allowing the actor Tom Hanks to come into the country and to film in Queensland, you know. So I guess these really emotional cases have started to focus the public debate on whether there are inconsistencies in the border. And while people are generally happy with the way Palaszczuk has handled things, we have this sort of scattergun from the LNP where they're sort of picking holes in that policy. And I think in the process, it kind of really highlights the fact that there's great risk in both strategies here.
And she has backtracked over the ACT border now, hasn't she, Ben?
Yeah, on Friday, the Premier did say that as of this coming Saturday, travel will be allowed between Queensland and the ACT. And that still comes with a huge number of complications because the ACT's border isn't shut. So if someone, for instance, from Queensland were to go to the ACT and they've come in contact with someone from Sydney, for instance, they'll likely be made to quarantine when they come back. So it's still, you know, very kind of complex and ever-evolving situation. I think that's the one thing to kind of keep in mind with this election is that it is dictated by the virus and no one knows what's likely to happen tomorrow in terms of case numbers. No one knows where and when there might be another spike in infections, and no one really knows kind of exactly how that border and restriction situation is going to evolve. So everyone, including the two campaigns, is really guessing as to what comes next.
Next, the election strategy for the LNP and the minor parties. So that's Labor. Tell us a bit about the other side.
Deb Frecklington is the leader of the LNP opposition.
The LNP have a plan to get Queensland working again. Scott Piper and I are here at Rolling Stone talking to these local pineapple growers all about the LNP's plan to supercharge the regions. Now, the
LNP knows Frecklington's from Kingaroy, which is the Joe Bjorke-Peterson heartland, really, of Queensland.
Now, Mr. Acting Speaker, as you know, I am from regional Queensland and I am proud of it. My team fights for the regions because we listen to the regions.
Earlier this year in June, she survived what was a backroom-led leadership challenge. There were figures within the party administration who got some polling that showed that she had really failed to cut through against Palaszczuk. And despite the fact that the polling has pretty consistently since the last election shown the LNP in a narrow lead statewide, the reality is that everyone knew we were heading towards this kind of presidential campaign where if Frecklington was polling poorly against Palaszczuk, that really wasn't going to play in her favour.
Is there anything else about this election we should know about?
I think it's a really interesting election because it's the first state election or first real major election in Australia where both leaders of the major parties are women.
And has that, you know, shaped the campaign in any way?
I think we're yet to see how voters will react to that situation, but there was some backlash earlier in this year when Frecklington criticised Palaszczuk for her fashion choices and implied that she was grounded because she had children, Palaszczuk not having children.
Wow, what century are we in? How did that go down?
Well, it didn't go down particularly well. The comments were pretty roundly criticised at the same time, and Frecklington said that her words had been twisted, and I guess we got into that kind of ugly space that we sometimes do when we're talking about female political leaders and whether they should be judged about their policies or their fashion choices. And you may have thought that in an election with two women leading both major parties that we might be a little bit immune from that sort of a thing. But look, we haven't heard that sort of a comment from Frecklington since, but I think it does point to something interesting here, and that is that, you know, Frecklington has had trouble criticising Palaszczuk. You know, the backlash to those comments, the calls for the border to be reopened kind of prompting a bit of a backlash. And I think it's partly why we're seeing these kind of federal figures, these heavy hitters of federal politics, sort of weighing into the election campaign a little bit more. They're able to kind of lead the attacks for Frecklington.
Ben, we've talked a lot about the pandemic, how this is basically a pandemic election, but are there any other factors that could change the course of this election?
Yeah, there absolutely are. The minor parties are always a wild card in Queensland. Last election, there was a lot of talk about the One Nation factor that didn't really kind of come through as we had expected, but because minor parties do play a bigger part in elections in Queensland generally, it's hard to kind of look at statewide kind of polling and say, well, this is how it's going to translate across the state, because, you know, there are certain minor parties, the Greens in progressive inner city areas, you've got the Katter Party in North Queensland, One Nation in some of the working class areas of central Queensland that do have kind of dedicated long-term followings. So they'll play a part. Whether they play as big a part in this election where people are so reliant upon government, people are looking to government for, essential information and kind of management of their day-to-day lives. So whether that does kind of dull the desire for people to vote for third party or protest candidates remains to be seen. But a lot of analysts seem to think that will be the case.
So is there anyone you think we should be watching?
Well, we should always watch what Clive Palmer does.
Queensland's in a swamp. I'm the wealthiest person in Queensland, but I couldn't invest here under this sort of government, under this sort of legislation.
We saw him spend $80 million on advertising, which was designed in the end to damage the Labor Party at the federal election. His party only won 3.4% of the vote at the federal election, and no serious analyst thinks that the United Australia Party can win a seat at the Queensland election. But he's back again. The yellow billboards are all around the middle of Brisbane with the give Labor the boot message on them. So, last week he pumped $2 million from his flagship business into the campaign. So it will be really interesting to see whether he attempts to shape this campaign in the same way that he tried to shape the federal election and just what sort of an impact that will have.
As to whether he could run a similar campaign against Queensland Labor.
The legislation limits the amount of free speech you can have in Queensland.
Mr. Palmer says he'll be endorsing around 40 candidates in coming weeks, but has ruled out running himself. Voters head to the polls on October 31.
And you mentioned One Nation earlier, and of course Pauline Hanson is from Queensland. So what are their chances at this election?
I think there is a lot less buzz around the impact of One Nation than there was in 2017. That was kind of at the height of Pauline Hanson's rebirth. And I think people were surprised in the end that they only won one seat. But rather than perhaps looking at how many seats One Nation might win, I think there's still value in looking at how they may upset the apple cart in some areas, particularly in terms of where their preferences head. They do a preference deal with the LNP that might bring some you know, very strong Labor heartland seats like Mackay and Rockhampton into play for the LNP. So, you know, I think it's really clear that the LNP is attempting to get preferences from One Nation voters, both federally and at a state level. So watching how that shapes up, I think, will be interesting as well.
Has there been any indication that the LNP is trying to get their preferences?
Well, we did see Pauline Hanson last week rock up and take kind of personal credit for a $23 million federal government grant to build a stadium in Rockhampton. And that, I guess, turns focus to the fact that One Nation has voted with the LNP federally, you know, far more than they've voted against. So,
wait, so Hanson took credit for a federal government grant to a Rockhampton stadium?
That's absolutely right. So
how does that work?
Well, I think the only way you'd be able to take credit for a grant like that is if you'd used it as a bargaining chip at some point in terms of some negotiation. But I mean, the Nationals MP for the area, Michelle Landry, was also present at the presentation where it was announced. You know, the Rocky Sports Club co-founder has said that Hanson and Landry were both behind the project and that it wouldn't have happened without either of them. So, you know, it is an interesting situation, though, the kind of the overtures that the LNP is sort of making to One Nation and to One Nation voters as well.
So where does all this leave the Greens then?
Well, the Greens have actually talked up the possibility of winning seven seats in inner Brisbane.
Wow.
Those prospects are dismissed by the major parties, but it's unavoidable that the Green vote has been increasing and they are going to make a number of inner city seats three-sided contests that where the election math and really who finishes slightly in front of who is ultimately going to determine who wins out of the LNP, Labor and the Greens. And what they've really done is they've capitalised on policy areas where Labor has drifted to the right in order to try and shore up their regional support.
Mm.
I think progressive people have a real difficulty trying to rate the Palaszczuk government. They've done some very progressive things. Abortion law reform, you know, overturning the decriminalisation that had been in place since 1899. They have introduced a Human Rights Act. There's been tree clearing legislation, barrier reef protections. They've made wage theft a crime. They introduced laws to allow traditional Torres Strait adoption. So these are all like really quite progressive things. And it does give them, I guess, a way to make an overture to progressive voters. But at the same time, when you look at their record on coal, for instance, the fact that they did capitulate to Adani after the federal election and make concessions to them, they have shifted to the right on coal, unquestionably. They introduced anti-protest laws that were designed to curb climate protests in the city. These are things that make it a very difficult legacy for people of the left to try and assess. And the Greens, I think, are you know, capitalising on that in inner city areas. So it will be really interesting to see, again, how the pandemic brings that into focus, whether people err on the side of the major parties and stability in government. But I think above all else, the contest that we're really all looking at is South Brisbane, which is held by the former Treasurer and Deputy Premier, Jackie Trad, one of the most progressive members of the Labor government, but that he's expected to come under a real immense challenge from the Greens.
Well, that certainly sounds very interesting, Ben, and we'll talk to you again before the election. Thanks for coming on today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gabrielle.
That's it for today. Thanks to Ben Smee for his time. You can read all his reporting on the Queensland election at theguardian.com. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, and why not tell your family and friends about it? This episode was produced by Joe Koning and Ellen Leibeater. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. See you tomorrow.